Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is about episode 10 of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, the epic story of the star that gives us life. We've looked at the mystical and mythic and cultural uses of the sun, and how the sun has been used to prop up... the power of the sun has been morphed into the power of a ruling class in many cases, and in legends and stuff like that. We've seen how the Greek astrology, it was Babylonian astrology, transformed to Greek astronomy, where they actually said, is there an engine, is there some mechanism behind it? And we saw the different schools emerge. Greeks goes for these various things. Essentially, they had they had maths, but no experiments. I suppose they did have predictive power, but they had sort of stumbled upon some good ideas and some bad ideas. So the good ideas is that spheres are good. So the sun is a sphere, and the sun goes around a sphere. But they had no evidence for it. They had little bits of pieces of evidence here, but they still tried to morph it onto the sun. There's some sort of god system. System in it, and of course, for everything to be spherical and to go around in circles, there's got to be a special state of matter which exists above the orbit of the moon. So that they had the belief that comets and such had to actually were things that darted beneath the orbit of the moon. They were atmospheric itself, and it was pretty good. I should go into it. I suppose the major insight is that Ptolemy was not a genius, or not a, he was just a, basically a Carl Sagan who actually put together, he was a Carl Sagan of the ancient world. He put together the thoughts of the other people and presented them, but because we don't have anything else, we sort of have put him up to the same level as the other things. He was more a commentator, and view is something, a view which exists right up into the Enlightenment, is that knowledge has been discovered and we are only curators of it, we're not developers of it. And so essentially, science was basically a museum, like science. So if you can imagine the US, NASA's gone and there's only the Smithsonian, because that's where the punters go. Punters go to the Smithsonian. And so Smithsonian reflects and describes it. And so you have a few people coming up with ideas, but in general there's a backwash of, religious thinking, which is holding science back, and no one dares go past it. But it's a necessary step. These are necessary steps to go from astrology to astronomy, from religion to science. Okay, this is chapter 7, episode 10. Two pre-chapters, preface and a random chapter at the start. And then Enter the Greeks, I did that in two episodes. And I just basically have a thing. This is Gifts from the Yellow Emperor. This is about the Chinese. And this is a quote by from 1910. This is he's a brilliant author, this person, even though he's missed a few major things in his argument, which would have supported his argument, like Parmenides. If he properly got the writing off, and he had some insights, but not complete insights across. Okay, so this is André de Saussure, 1910, and he says, among the Greeks, the astronomers was a private person, a philosopher, a lover of truth. In China, on the contrary, he was intimately connected with the sovereign pontificate of the Son of Heaven, part of the official government service, ritually accommodated within the very walls of the imperial palace. Okay, here, this is interesting that the Greeks had a, now I would say this is, the Greeks had a religion which it could be run without a central control, because Greece had the Mediterranean in the very, if you look at the epicenter of Greece, it's somewhere in the middle of the Mediterranean. It's just sea. So your religion has to be something which works without a person there. It's got to be more conceptual. Here, they've got the Sun King, or the Sun of Heaven. So these are heavenly people. And so they've actually been able to morph their religious people with the Sons of Heaven. Okay, now, another quote is Zhu Yunbao writing to Matteo Ricci. So Matteo Ricci is someone who actually, I think, a Jesuit or something like that. Someone who went to China around the time of Marco Polo. I should just say that I'm doing all of this reading for cognitive rehab, just to get the brain working back and forth, getting facts and stuff like that. So I don't know, there's certain areas which I just, for the life of me, can't remember something for a full 20 minutes, and then it suddenly pops out for no reason whatsoever. Or this, the handwriting goes good and bad and stuff like that. So let's hope this goes well. Now his person is, the people of our humble land have always understood heaven. Isn't that beautiful? And it's not understood heaven, but the understood of the heavens. Isn't it beautiful? So much for our understanding of China in general, and its solar science in particular, depends on the work of one Western scholar, the remarkable British polymath Joseph Needham, whose life spanned the 20th century, 1900 to 1995. He's been compared with both Darwin and Gibbon in bestriding his area of study. A contemporary went so far as to claim that one would have to reach back to Leonardo to find so much learning in a single individual, which, of course, I've never heard of before. Needham's knowledge embraced mathematics, physics, history, philosophy, religion, astronomy, geography, geology, seismology, mechanical and civil engineering, chemistry and chemical technology, biology, medicine, sociology and economics. He spoke 8 languages with comfort, wrote poetry throughout his life, and was profoundly committed Christian and communist, while other interests ranged from Morris dancing to steam trains, accordion playing and nudism. This is a hero. What a beautiful way he said. And this author had its beautiful way of summarizing the Greeks. He said, starting with, I think it was with Pythagoras, and expanded by Plato and whatever it is, and then written up by Ptolemy. It's a beautiful way that he added. But this is what a fantastic thing. He spent most of his life in Cambridge, initially, specializing in embryology. Oh, that's interesting. Isn't that beautiful? Because that was Aristotle's start. And morphogenesis. And in 1922, marrying a fellow Dom, biochemist Dorothy May Moyle. Then, in 1937, a Chinese postdoctoral student, Liu Guijian, arrived in the Department of Biochemistry. Needham fell in love and totally redirected his intellectual pursuits. He taught himself enough Mandarin to get by and became obsessed with the two questions. Why were the Chinese so unaware of their past scientific achievements? And why had not the scientific revolution swept through the 7th century Europe taken place in China first? And I think, I don't know whether this is Needham's insight, it was the actual invention of glasses which extended the academic age, working life of people in the West, and writing and stuff like that. Also, I think there's people begin to understand the geography of China. Its rivers are not navigable for cargo, so trade developed in a different way, whereas Europe was able to use much more boats. Just before the outbreak of the Second World War, so this is eyeglasses, didn't happen in China, so that would have changed things. But also there's other people who've people people have analysed the actual geography of China and saying, well, because of the mountain ranges and the landlocked and the neighbours, and the orientation was just the wrong shape of land. Needham signed a contract with Cambridge University Press to write a one-volume history taking up the fundamental question of why modern science organised in Europe and not in China. Going out in 1943, he spent 2 years at the British scientific mission in Chongqing, the Nationalist Party capital of China. And for the next 6 years, he travelled the country by whatever conveyance was available, jeeps and junks, camels and wheelbarrows, litters and goatskin rafts, collecting rare works of traditional learning as he went. He returned home, his short study having grown to 3 volumes. This first appeared in 1954, included a table of contents for the entire enterprise, which at that point he was projecting to 7 volumes. Eventually, those 7 would become 27, and mostly written by Needham, who worked at them almost until his death at 95. The chapters on astronomy fill 300 pages. While his remarkable work has been augmented over the years and sometimes corrected in its detail, it's never been replaced. There you go. You know, what the heck? You know, it's almost so grades of isolation. Like, education is years out of date, extremely isolated. Academia here, I'd say, would be 10 years behind technology, the top of technology, and isolated again. So it's not surprising, it's rather sad that I haven't known of this kid person. In one central myth of China's beginning, the early king Fu He and his 4 successors, they're known as the 5 sovereigns, are said to have founded the Chinese Empire, ruling from 3000 to 1600 BC, which is a very long time. Expanding the kingdom from from now north central China to the eastern sea, a huge territory with a 8,700 mile coastline. A competing myths present a certain Huang Yan or Hong Di, the Yellow Emperor, who became the first leader of all the northern tribes after decisively defeating his enemies in 2698 BC. He could move through the air at enormous speed, riding a dragon as high as the sun, his beasts having come from the land where the suns are born. Okay, well, there you go. Legend told that he believed that numbers had philosophical and metaphysical properties and helped to achieve spiritual harmony with the cosmos. Oh, what a go. Look at that. But you can see corrupting the power of the sun. Of course, if you're out in the sticks, you know, you're just out in nowhere land, right, with birds and stuff going around, you have to find something powerful. Well, the big powerful thing which is affecting you is the sun, obviously. Both Huang and Fu He, like the Babylonians, are said to have devised a numerical system based on 60 as part of the method of timekeeping known as the heavenly stems or earthly branches. Yeah, and 60's got something like, I do my, I have to do rounds of, I've got this rehab today, but I've got to do rounds of 20 push-ups, so that's 12 and 6, not push-ups. They're not going to get me to do push-ups, bloody hell. And you've got to hold for 3, down for 2, so it's 5-second brackets, and so 20 is 1.5 turns. It's sort of really rather good, that of the clock. So 1.5, and that, yeah, you think 1.5 minutes of doing an exercise, it's just agony. Okay, mythical thought, though these figures were, there is some truth in what the myths describe. The first dynasty appears in Chinese records at Zai, running from 2033 to 1562 BC. During the subsequent Shang or Yin dynasty, another 500 years, 1556 to 1045 BC, the Chinese developed a calendar, learned how to write, and became highly proficient at bronze metallurgy. This era was a critical time for Chinese intellectual history. We know that they were investigating the heavens, so just at this time the Babylonians were mucking around with clay tablets. Yeah. Okay, we know these were investigating the heavens by the 15th and 7th century BC. The inscriptions suggest that I think parchment is actually beaten out cow skin. I'm not sure myself. But papyrus is paper. Yeah, I'll just work out. So papyrus is reeds, papyrus rolls. Work out. Okay. We know that they were investigating the heavens by the 15th century BC. Okay, what's the thing? An inscription suggests that by the 14th, well before the earliest known Sumerian calendars, they had established a solar year of 365 and a quarter days. Bloody hell, isn't that spot on? Formulated a system of measuring time, daily time, incorporated cardinal points of direction into their cartography and mapped the paths of the sun and the moon accurately enough to predict eclipses. Astronomy was of vital interest to the Chinese, and considerable resources were devoted to it. Early in his account, Nida makes it clear that until at least the 6th century AD, they connected celestial heavens with the performance of their rulers, whom they saw as divinely appointed. The earth, its emperors, and the entire cosmos were one, and so long as the sovereign governed well, celestial bodies would follow their appointed courses without deviation or surprise. Okay, this is putting up the tension, isn't it? It's not that when you do something wrong, it affects the heavens. It's sort of like a broadcasting. It's like an eye in the sky. It's sort of a different concept, isn't it? From you're going along and you're having luck happening all the time, and when the gods are angry, they show it, and then that you start having bad luck. You create bad luck, and then the things go out of whack. It's pretty much. Where his reign unjust or otherwise defective, comets and new stars would blaze across the sky. Since unusually heavenly events either presaged disaster or pointed to inadequacies in administration, a ruler had good reasons to keep such portents secret. The records were closely guarded. While major happenings were visible to all, many lesser ones were not noticed and could be passed over or publicized as well. Thus, many astronomers gained considerable power, even influencing policy, were central figures of court life. Which isn't that interesting. Of course, it's where these consultants actually gain huge power. In the Aztec, they had the speaking stones that the priests could listen to. Sort of like having a glove puppet to speak. Look, I think the stone is saying you've got to pay me more money. Yeah, the stone says maybe a little bit more. It's pretty amazing, that type of stuff. They developed the so-called techniques of destiny, which included inscribing predictions on the shoulder blades of oxen and deer or tortoise shells. These oracle bones are the main source of information about the period between the 14th and 11th BC. So the bones still arrive. Which is, there's the Inuits who used to get the shoulder bones of caribou and roast them, and the cracks would appear. That would be their map. Of course, the caribou had no way of predicting it. And one of the important things, this sort of comes down to, one of the important things about religion is that there are so many different things which that puts people's minds away from the actual most logical path. It picks a completely new innovative path, and you actually require innovation to actually make religion work. It's a pretty amazing thing. It's sort of like involuntary addiction to a base load of manageable innovation. Given the discipline's potential as an instrument of intrigue, independent astronomers might be tempted to calculate horoscopes to the advantage of arrival would be dinners. The emperors made it a crime to leak astronomical information, just as the Tibetans, Tiberius or Nero's would later do in Rome. A typical edict declares, quote, "If we hear of any intercourse between astronomical officials or the subordinates and officials of other government departments or miscellaneous common people, it will be regarded as a violation of security regulations. Astronomical officials are on to no accounts to mix with civil servants and common people in general. Let the censorate look at it. Even the studying of astronomy in private was punishable by a 2-year prison sentence. Whoa! And this is another thing, isn't that the most incredible thing? It's come from Satan. And it's interesting. You imagine me, not knowing about Needham, sort of like the Chinese not knowing about the West. I didn't know about Needham. And this is a totally different take on astronomy, isn't it? The most startling difference between Chinese and Western astronomy was the method Chinese used to track the planets through the night sky. They named the ecliptic the yellow path. Isn't that beautiful? The ecliptic yellow path. Why yellow path? With set numbers of houses, then 10 heavenly stems positioned along it. They combined with both the 12 earthly branches another sequence of 5 elements to create cycles of 60 hours, days and years. Gosh, that's really making my head spin. To make the construct easy to remember, each branch was the same. Oh, the annual symbol. Okay. So far as the historian of science is concerned, Needham commented tersely, whoever invented the animal cycle is welcome to it. As he notes, a Western astronomer would hardly recognize a map of constellation produced by Chinese astrologers. A far point, as the most menagerie does tend to obscure the real advances the Chinese made. Isn't that beautiful? It's still got the year of that, the year of that. It's really pretty amazing. I don't know how they do it. That's interesting. Okay, there's a annual symbol. There's a footnote. The myth developed that the Buddha invited all the animals to celebrate the new year, but only 12 turned up: mouse, ox, tiger, rabbit, dragon, snake, horse, sheep, monkeys, rooster, dog, and pig, in the order they are now in the zodiac. Out of gratitude, he decided to name the years after them, in order in the order of their rival, people born in a given year, inheriting the personality traits of a particular animal. Is that the Buddha? I didn't know that sort of thing happened. My understanding of Buddha, I thought it was Buddha was a much more down to earth person, not inviting talking animals. Right. But he said 10 houses. I don't quite understand it. It's interesting that they have got 12 zodiac signs. The recording of astronomical, and it's also, what is it, the star chart. They're seeing there's a Chinese star sign. Of course, the Yanks hate that. I know this because I'm negotiating this complicated thing with an American city to give them a Chinese star, and they hate it. The recording of astronomical observations and cultural practices tend to go together. The Li Kai, the Book of Rites, for instance, a compilation of religious practices from the 8th to the 5th century BC, describes the sons of heaven, king's emperor, as a stargazer whose function was to predict the moment when his people were to participate in the rites of heaven and earth by sowing the new season's grain. Stargazing, as with the ancient priests, was seen as part of everyday life. As late as the Ming scholar Gu Huang wrote, in Shai, Shang, and Zhui dynasty, everyone was an astronomer. Astronomy was Tian Wei, literally the pattern of the sky. Isn't it like the pattern of the skies? I love that, pattern of the skies. Encompassed a systematic study of all heavenly events, the waxing and waning of the moon, the movement of the planets, the type and the colour of the comets. The project mapping the heavens was not new to Chinese, but along with the Babylonians, they were most persevering and accurate observers until the Arabs, and from the middle of the 14th century BC on, they recorded 900 solar eclipses Over the next 2,600 years, the Chinese of this era also noted the appearance of sunspots. They are mentioned at least 120 times in official histories, although observation of the shape and splitting of such spots did not come until much later. They were first noticed in 28 BC. This was long before they were written up in the West. One wonders how the Chinese saw spots at all when their skies were not especially clear. And given good conditions, the spot has to be more than 5,000 miles in diameter to be visible to the naked eye. Wow. Gee whiz, isn't that incredible? The 6th century BC saw the standardization of weights and measures and other practicalities such as the width of roads. Even gourmands were officially set to 8 chi. So I don't know what a gourmand meters. I don't know what a G-N-O-M-O-N-S. I don't know what they are. That's something I should look up. Okay. I put it in my memory. It will not stay there. So it's give another chance. G-N-O-M-O-N-S. So they've got a height of 2.4 meters. I suppose it's an astronomical thing. There might be a stick you put in the ground. By the 5th century, the Chinese understood what caused eclipses and were the first to record the appearance of what we call Halley's Comet in 467 BC. Between 370 and 270 BC, two of the greatest Chinese astronomers, Shi Shen and Kan Ti, along with his colleague Wu Sen, drew up the first star categories to give some idea of how advanced it was. Hipparchus would not produce comparable work for another two centuries. In all this, the sun operated as one force among many. Chinese painted screens depicting the universe often omitted the sun altogether. To give its primacy would be to disturb the balance of nature. The Chinese saw the heavens as a bowl turned upside down, resting on a square earth, with four cardinal points in terrestrial space, north, south, east, and west, and the fifth in the centre, the heart point of the celestial realm. The sun was essentially a circumpolar star, illuminating first one zone of earth, then another. The sun and the moon were attached to the heaven, which moved at great speed, carrying them along with it. Dear. From 200 BC on, the main observatory under the Qin dynasty employed a corps of 300 astronomical experts. They divided the sky into 28 unequal sectors radiating from the north celestial pole in the same way that the lines of longitude radiate from the poles of the celestial grade, derived from the moon's apparent motion set against the stars, which allowed them to calculate the sidereal month of 27.32 days. Each astronomer employed a cosmograph or shipam, the rotating disk of heaven above a square fixed plate of earth. Around the disk's edge were marked the names of 28 constellations, while the disk's center was the representation of the plough. The instruments enabled the user to locate a star at any time of year and also functioned as a clock. Once the astronomers had calculated what star was passing the meridian at sunset, he could tell which constellation had reached its zenith at noon or midnight, and knowing that a particular constellation had risen at vernal equinox, which stars were reaching their high point, or alternatively were on their way down. Sometime before the 2nd century BC, this cosmograph would evolve into a compass, its function of shifting from the celestial to the terrestrial. Isn't that amazing? So, this is, you know, the Europeans were held back by not having a compass, and the Chinese had a compass at what time? 2nd century BC. That's just disgusting. So the Europeans, I mean, I think the Vikings had some sort of form of lodestone compass, but I don't think the Romans did. Chinese astronomy thus predicted on a very different system from that of the Greeks and other later Europeans. The Egyptians and Greeks charted the sun's rising and settings and those of other stars near the ecliptic. So, for instance, the rising of Sirius, measured against the successive sunrises, would announce when the Nile was about to flood. Such observations were needed, required no knowledge of pole, meridian, or equator, or any system of orary measurement. So the Chinese had a full set. They just clamped it down to two points. You know, Sirius, what Sirius is doing. The Chinese focused instead on the pole star and the circumpolar brethren, basing their system on meridian, a great cycle celestial sphere passing the pole star at the observer's zenith, and calculating the culminations of the lower transits. Pole star, immediate neighbours. A circumpolar star is one that, as viewed from any given angle on Earth, never sets. Well, obviously, you've got to be far enough up in the northern hemisphere, don't you? I never dissipates below the horizon. Due to proximity either to the celestial poles, such stars, therefore, are visible from the location for the entire night and every night of the year, and were continuously visible from the day too, if it were not for the overwhelming sun's glare. Okay. Not the two systems were entirely separate. Homer, for one, was aware of the significance of the pole star as the mark of the north. And the sentinels at the siege of Troy charged their guard according to the vertical and horizontal position of the tail of the great bear. I think that might be Orion. Such approach had a clever scientific basis, but for most Chinese, the understanding of the heavens and thus the sun was bound up in the overall way of looking at the world. Chinese cosmology affirms life of balance and virtue of performing one's duty, and their philosophy of what occurs in the heaven reflects whether or not that balance is achieved, particularly as understood through their three key terms, Qi, Yin, and Yang. Both before 300 BC, Qi is the narrowest sense, means life energy. Okay. Thereafter, it's used to cover a multitude of phenomena, air, breath, smoke, mist, fog, shades of death. Also, clouds form more or less anything perceptible but intangible. The physical vitalities, cosmic forces, and climatic influences that affect health and common seasons, many of the sun's effects were manifested as qi. Flavors, colors, musical notes, qi could be benign, protective, pathological, an agent of disease, or destructive. Wow. Qi is basically concept, their stab at what a concept is. One of the primary schools of Chinese thought, Taoism, it's T-A-O-I-S-M, is a philosophy of duality and balance. Thus, the doctrine of yin and yang, which embraces almost all opposable force, yin being cool and wet and female, yang being hot and dry and male. All these antitheses include day and night, light and dark, honest and deceitful. Taoists propound the idea that the yin and yang surge to the earth. They cause periodic changes that bring about tides, seasons, heats and colds. They believe the numbers were key to maintaining balance, five being particularly auspicious. Each of the five prime locations on Earth, north, south, east, west, and center, having a corresponding color, animal, element, and flavor. Nine was also important, but not so auspicious, as the number needed to be heeded, so that the ninth day of the ninth month, the double yang, the people of Beijing would auspiciously set out to climb two of the city's main hill, the wall of pure metropolis, and the destiny of trees surrounding the gate of Qi, in order to avoid disaster. Well, that's just ripper. We're going to find out what 8 is. Yin and Yang modified Qi. Okay. They were complementary aspects of any configuration of space-time, or time. What Needham calls the two fundamental forces of operations of the universe. The sun was a fiery yang nature, the moon and the earth were yin, air, and simply vacuum. In most cultures, the sun had several synonyms, including radiant numbers, Yoling, Vermilong, Vermilion Luminosity, Chungmeng, Lord of the East, Tai Chung, Great Luminosity, Tai Ming, Crow of Yang, and Fluid Pearl. The Indian comments that the Chinese elite use many cinnamons precisely in order to bewilder the uninitiated. It's the amazing. The sun was a fiery yang neck. Okay. The distinction between bodies that shone by their own light and those that shone by reflected light. For them, there were five phases, wuxing, and five powers, or the five travelers, because the continual movements, or five life processes, wood, fire, earth, metal, and water. Mm. By the 2nd century AD, no one was sure what the unifying principles of these minerals were, but despite such uncertainty, a common language emerged to describe the cosmos and its analogues on Earth. For both the state and individual, a dynamic harmony existed, leading one true way. The classifying system originated in humanistic thought, then passed to state cosmology, and from there was taken up by scientists. Isn't that a beautiful thought? Humanistic thought, the state, and then science. Scientists often take things from the state. Okay, by 221 BC, the Eastern Kingdoms were forged together to become China. The great central state of Qin, or China, means land of the house of Qin, was translated as middle. Qin was the middle kingdom. The long distances and physical barriers had isolated from other civilizations, gave its people the impression that their country was the center of the earth, the sole source of civilization, the idea that would persist for millennia. However, China's expansion into Central Asia in the 1st century AD would expose astronomers to Hindu-Persian ideas, provoking intense speculation in cosmology and astronomy. Some of these doctrines were almost too far ahead of their time. In AD 5, Wang Mang, 45 BC to 23 AD, and you remember there's no 0 AD, so that's you just can't subtract those two numbers from each other. So it's 45 and 22, there you go. So that's 78. Regent and later emperor argued from what he had learned from the foreign influences that the workings of the heavens happened of themselves, and natural disasters were not seen to warn and punish, a thesis which largely unheard. Another theory that won wide acceptance associated with the later Han Dynasty, 25 to 220. So there's some things that the geography meant that China had these long stable kingdoms, but it also meant they were isolated for long times. Pictured the universe as an unending empty space which floated the sun, the moon, planets and stars. Notable as the first time anyone in any country had suggested the infinite and uncentered universe. Most of Chinese mathematics, say from 100 BC on, was devoted to calculating the calendar and predicting the positions of heavenly bodies. As it was, Chinese calendric science produced a strong tradition of algebraic arithmetical astronomy, in contrast with the Western emphasis on geometry. So we have star charts, they have numbers. In 132, China's greatest grand astrologer, Zhang Heng, I'm sorry for you Chinese people listening to this, 78 to 139 AD, basing his insights on such mathematics, invented the world's first seismoscope for registering earthquakes. A cylindrical device with eight dragon heads around the top, each with a ball in its mouth, and eight frogs, one directly beneath each dragon. On the bottom, when the shockwave came, the ball would clatter out of the dragon's mouth into the frogs. Chang also wrote moonlight is only reflected sunlight. At lunar phases are the result of the moon's change in reflection of sunlight from different positions of course. He invented the world's first simple water-powered arbitrary sphere and documented, invented the world's first water-powered arbitrary sphere, documented 2,500 stars in his extensive star catalogue, and invented the astrolabe for graduated rings and with a sighting tube. Wow. Astrolabes show how the sky ideally looks at a specific place and time. This is done by drawing the constellation on the faces and marking them in positions in the sky are easily defined. Once set, the instrument's face has a complete representation of the eye sky, showing many astronomical problems to be solved visually. Isn't that amazing? So I really don't know what an astrolabe is, and what was that other thing I was trying to remember? Gourmand. Astrolabe Gourmand. While his fellow Chinese were reacting to lunar eclipses by pounding gongs, Zhang was explaining their real cause. Needham believes he set, quote, the standard for excellence in astronomy. Although even Zhang was partly conditioned by the thinking of his time. While he was the first in China to construct a celestial globe that actually turned, it bore little or no relationships to reality, but rather reflected his vision of the universe expressed in the hue and chew, the heavens like a hen's egg, and as round as a crossbow bullet. What? They were firing bullets from crossbows? My godfather. The earth is like a yolk of an egg and lies along the center. The heaven is large and the earth is small. And the passage is not translated by, Needham, saying adds, heaven takes its body from the yang, and so it is round and in motion. Earth takes its body from the yin, so it's flat and quintessent. Isn't that amazing? Between the 2nd and 11th century AD, little change to China. So that's still in understanding of the sun. Although their astronomical literacy was equal to in extent to both botany, zoology, pharmacy, medicine taken together. By the 12th century, the Imperial Library contained 369 books on astronomy and allied subjects. And by the 13th, the Empire's astronomical instruments were far superior to anything in Europe. However, the non-geometrical nature of its mathematics left it still unable to chart the skies accurately and hampered further progress. Isn't that amazing? So you really need algebra and geometry to help you out. This was a consequence of its isolation. Until about AD 400, the country was almost completely shut off all but its immediate neighbours. Christian missionaries made the arduous journey overland as early as the following century. 500 AD? My God. But there was little, if any, cross-fertilisation of ideas, and the countries did not become an object of general curiosity until the West in 1250, when Pope Innocent sent Franciscan monks to Asia to discover civilization that was in many ways remarkably advanced. And so they had, obviously you had the Mongol invasions before that, but also Europe was imploding at that time. It wasn't doing well. So these guys, a lot of these people, asked the Christians in, and they just said, look, I think Marco Polo's parent. It's interesting that Marco Polo is a family. The father and uncle had been, they were the second Polos. Marco Polo was not the first Polo, but there was a second Polo going in. I read a bit about it. Now, Astrolabe and Gourmand. So you can see me remembering. The Franciscan reports were augmented by several decades later by Marco Polo, 1254 to 1324, who, writing about the period towards the end of the 13th century, describes the land of an immense extent, with the largest cities, the wildest rivers, the greatest plains ever seen, where gunpowder, coal, printing were in general use. One might add that the economy based on paper money, cities with over a million people, a genuine bureaucracy, items such as silk, tea, porcelain, herbal medicine, lacquer paint, playing cards, rockets, astronomical clocks, dominoes, wallpaper, kites, and even a folding umbrella. Marco Polo was describing China as it was under Kublai Khan, during whose Oh my God, there's a huge footnote here. Rain, the Chinese Empire stretched from the Pacific to much of Eastern Europe. China was a foreign influence as never before. Eastern Europe. So this is when this is at the end of the Mongol dynasty. Now here's a huge footnote. Let's read it. How far, if at all, ancient Chinese autonomy influenced the West? In 1826, the Palace Museum at Beijing sent two horse bones to the British Museum asking for help. Both bore fragments of a cruciform script, and one was identified as a poor copy of a cylinder of which the BM has an example, British Museum has an example, that describes the conquest of Babylon by Cyrus II of Persia in 539 BC. At first it was presumed that the horsebone script with its square structure and pictographic aspects was a forgery, but after a long study the experts decided it was genuine. Had it suddenly turned up in Beijing? In 1987, an article appeared in the Chinese Historical Journal by one Yu Xinwei, a doctor in traditional medicine, who had died well into his 80s the year before. Travelling in eastern China in 1928, he learned of the bones from a local scholar. In the years that followed, he monitored their progress, and over a decade later bought them from the antique dealer who had told him that his purchases came from the northwest Xinjiang, a desert around Guge. The villagers were called such pieces dragon bones and used them as spindles. During the destructive excesses of the Cultural Revolution, Shishun buried the two bones when he judged it safe to dig them up. Just before his death, he gave them to the Palace Museum. Xing probably lay on the line of the old trade route, so the 4th century BC visitors from the West would indeed have carried the bones with them. I asked a senior member of the British Museum whether this discovery was not rather important. I suppose, he mused, we do tend to keep some things to ourselves. Oh well. 6 years after Beijing received its bones from... 6 years after Beijing received its bones, about 113 mummified corpses dating back to at least 3,800 years were excavated at Shishun, known as the land of irrevocable death. Oh dear. through which runs a key stretch of what would become the Silk Road for the 4,000-mile network of interconnecting beaten paths of caravan tracks that served from around 500 BC to 1500 AD as the main highway between Europe and Middle East, India and China. The bodies, although their skins are parched and blackened, have long noses, long skulls and deep-set eyes, typical of Caucasians, even blonde hair. Quichuan Desert of the Tasman Basin, modern Xinjiang, lying between the Gobi Desert and northeastern Himalayas in the south, is one of the four sites where such corpses have been found. Not in one or twos, but in groups of 30 or more, suggesting permanent settlements and not just a few stray travellers. Victor H. Mayer, Professor of Chinese Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, believes that these were substantial two-way traffic between east and west beginning at least 3,980 years ago. Would such caravans have brought scientific knowledge with them? We do not know. The present Chinese government has impeded further research, but at least two of the Tarmen mummies were still wearing their original silk clothes decorated with a star map, an ancient text, possibly Phoenician or a Phoenician in Phoenician on astronomy. Well, look, this is rich pickings. This is rich pickings. You can only say this in a book like this. What a footnote. Okay. Under the Ming Dynasty, which is the Ming, 1368 to 1644, the country again sealed itself off for more than 100 years, its astronomical undertakings sank into general deep sleep of science, a decline so precipitous that it's hard to believe it happened. But it may have been that the Chinese believed that because the good life had been discovered, the education need never change. Sort of, I think the US are a bit in that area. The situation would alter only with the oncoming of the Jesuits. They found a culture profoundly cut off from much of the knowledge of the West, including its geography as much as its astronomy. When the missionaries hung up a map of the world in his hut and invited the Chinese guests to examine it, he reported, and this is a quote, so this is a Jesuit, Hank. I've got a hut, here's a map of the world, here, have a look at it. To them, the heavens are round earth, are round, but the earth is flat and square. They firmly believe their empire is right in the middle of it. They do not like the idea of our geographies pushing their China to one corner of the Orient. They do not comprehend the demonstration as proof the earth is a globe made up of land and water. And the globe of its nature has neither beginning or end. The geographer will therefore be obliged to change his design and left a margin on either side of the map, making the kingdom of China appear right in the center, which is more in keeping with their ideas and gave it to them a great deal of pleasure and satisfaction. So, basically, China did not have geography, they didn't have the spheres, and so though it's incredibly advanced, there are certain things that they didn't do, and they thought that the stars were like a police state. It's pretty amazing. Chinese geography may have been backward, yet it was three Chinese inventions, the magnetic south-pointing compass, the true rudder, and ships that could sail to windward with compartmentalized hulls to make them less liable to sink when breached, that made it even more feasible for Europeans to sail eastward by sea. And is this really pointing that I wonder what you meant by southward pointing camp. Okay, now let's listen to this. Even then, in 1551, the first great missionary Francis Xavier sent out from neighbouring Japan, it took him 9 months of negotiation to establish himself on an island 7 miles offshore, and a further 9 weeks to set a foot on the mainland. Some 30 years later, an Italian member of the Society of Jesus, a mathematician, astronomer, Matteo Ricci, I knew that's what he was. I knew Ricci was a Jesuit. Took 4 months to reach Portuguese outpost of Macau, enduring illness, shipwreck, and imprisonment before finally entering Beijing. Ricci was the most notable of all Jesuit missionaries to China, the first Westerner to admit to Beijing and then Forbidden City. While baptizing many high officials, he acquainted his hosts with the advances of the Renaissance. Although he and his fellow Jesuits also imported many of the current scientific errors from Europe, and indeed would ridicule the notion of the emptiness of the heavens. Yet, as Needham observed, the vision of infinite space, with celestial bodies as rare intervals floating in it, is far more advanced than the rigid Aristotelian Ptolemaic conception of concentric crystalline spheres. So there you go. Both of them are pretty crap, weren't they? The spheres, and it's just a big map of China. As soon after his arrival in 1817, now I'm sure Ricci is that there's actually some modern mathematical theorems associated. So it's Gorman and Astrolabe, these are things I want to do. Set about expanding to his host what he had learnt in his European studies, even providing them with a world map that, among other things, proves the sun is larger than the moon. The Chinese resisted, as to their minds they were intellectual masters of the world, certainly within the sciences, until Ricci produced a China clock that he said replicated the movement of the stars. To test it, his host set about predicting the solar eclipse by their methods, while Ricci and his European assistants used the device. Chinese predicted hour came and went in the full sight of the sun. The Western predicted eclipse fell precisely on time. Wow. Oh, my godfather. Oh, is this not the most amazing book? Oh, gee, wow. As Rishi's renowns grew, he was invited to the country's most important observatory in Nanking. Instead of elaborate semi-magical charts here at the Expected Tower, he found magnificent instruments of cast bronze embellished with imperial dragons, more sophisticated than any he'd seen in Europe. A sphere determined the eclipse is marked with degrees according to the European system, but in Chinese characters. A Gorman, the largest of all, and a nest of four astrolabes. The eunuch in charge, in later periods of the Byzantine Empire, writes the historian Beverly Graves, the heavenly court found earthbound reflections on the imperial court. The eunuchs who surrounded the emperor, who were considered God's representatives, with their brilliant white clothing and glowing beardless faces, served the equivalent of angels. Sun Jiuqin and the last eunuch of the imperial court died as recently as 1996, age 93. He was... That's another aspect of it. Imagine having to be a eunuch wearing a white cloud and going around. And you can see these astrolabes. Aren't they beautiful? Wow. Ritzy examined one of the spheres and pointed to graduated arms. This is where you read the shadow. Eunuch point looked puzzled. He nodded before trying to pull the visitor away. But Ritzy continued his inspection, noticing the degrees were indicated a system of knobs that could be read at night by touch. He then made a sudden discovery. Surely the king stands at 32 degrees. This is going to be big. You agree. But this instrument is set for 36 degrees. His guide was silent and tried to again to divert Richie's attention. Intrigued, the guest posed two or three simple questions about the Gorman, all of which received evasive answers. Until at last, the chief eunuch confessed, "They are beautiful instruments, but we do not know how to use them." There were two sets made, one for Beijing, one for Pinyang. These are the Pinyang. Now Rishi understood. The town Pinyang stood at 36 degrees. The instruments had never been adjusted. There was no more than objects of magic. He gradually learned that the astronomical knowledge had come from the Arabs, so China had acquired its preliminary understanding of the planetary system from the same source at the same time as Europe. Oh, wow. In the reviving West, such information had been successfully received and elaborated. In China, where science was not judged a connection to good life or to good government, as opposed to astrology's value and source of predictions, it was not included in the approved list of studies. Ah, isn't that the most incredible thing? This is the richest book ever. Ritzy did his best to dispel such ignorance, but considerable opposition to his teaching remained. Not until 3 years after his death, when the Chinese Board of Astronomers seriously mistimed an eclipse, did the throne finally decree the calendar to brought up to date with the European works of astronomy translated. However, China was almost immediately invaded by Manchu. Order broke down nationwide and the country was once more closed off, isolated. It may have been, yet well into the 18th century, it held in awe many Europeans as the most prosperous, sophisticated of any civilization on Earth. Samuel Johnson's first prose work, 1733, refers to Chinese as perfectly, completely skilled in all sciences. Not until 1850 was their astronomy merged with the rest of the world. Today, the Imperial Observatory has its own subway station. Wow. Isn't that absolutely incredible story? What a beautiful story to bring out. This is, it shows the what a rich charged thing. You see an instrument and it's set incorrectly. Isn't that incredible? Okay, thanks a lot for listening.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.